My name is Elizabeth McGee, and I'm representing Teddy Leon Parker today. I assume the court is familiar with the facts.
We are, but do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, if I may reserve 3 minutes.
3 minutes, yes,
Thank
ma'am.
You. Assuming that the court is familiar with the facts, I would just like to clarify some misstatements in the Commonwealth's brief. First, on page 3 in the facts, it says that the bag containing the drugs is in plain view. We would argue that the bag, the opaque grocery bag, was in plain view, but not the drugs themselves contained therein, and that the officer did have to use a flashlight in order to view those drugs.
The bag was situated on the front seat?
Correct, Your Honor.
It was open at the top?
The officer did testify that it was partially open. There's nothing in the record to indicate how large of an opening it was.
Is there anything in the record to indicate whether or not an interior dome light was on since the driver's side door was left open?
No, Your Honor. The record is devoid of that. And that is one of our circumstances we would ask the court to take into consideration. Additionally, would just point out that on page 7, the Commonwealth indicates that I misplaced in citing Coward because the driver in that case was convicted. I would just point out to the court that the driver in that case did make statements that the vehicle belonged to his mother. He had been in the vehicle all night and that he was the only one driving it that night. And
but Coward was, and I'm somewhat familiar with that
yes,
opinion, Coward was quite different. The first of all, as I recall, it's like a tenth of a gram of cocaine wrapped up in a little tiny baggy corner stuck in an alcove or the console of the car. And this was a passenger in the car. There was nothing in the record to indicate how long he'd been in the car. And even the officer had to testify that it was only based on my training and experience that I recognized that baggy corner as possibly containing drugs. And then, most importantly, the driver, or the Coward, didn't run from the police. Isn't that a pretty significant difference?
Your Honor, I would actually argue there's much more similarities than the court's looking at. So first in Coward, the drugs found in the center console were in a clear plastic baggie. Here we have an opaque bag that the officer did testify that he could not see through that bag itself. You had to look down with the use of that flashlight to see inside of a partial opening. Again, we have no testimony of how large this opening was. It could have been smaller than the width of a pen or a pencil, could be larger than that. We don't know how large it was. Additionally, would argue that a factor that the Coward court looked at was that there were no furtive movements made. There were also no furtive movements made by Mr. Parker when
what
he
was driving.
What
about when he got out of the car and ran?
I would argue that would be flight as opposed to furtive movements.
I used to argue Proverbs many times that the guilty man fleeth where no man pursueth, and this guy just took off as soon as he saw a police car.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that he was driving with a suspended license. He did plead guilty to that. However, the trial court did dismiss that charge due to lack of evidence. But he also had active warrants. So we can assume that he was running due to those two factors as opposed to merely because...
Except we're viewing the evidence in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth. And in that light, the inference that a reasonable fact finder could conclude was he also had this bag of narcotics or drugs sitting on his console. That's why he fled.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that one of the elements is knowledge that a person knows of these drugs beside him, and I would submit that the evidence that he had knowledge is so lacking in this case that all the court relied on is the flight from the vehicle. And as we know, flight alone is not sufficient to find a person guilty. Here, again, we have it's dark, it's 3:30 in the morning, it's drizzly or raining. There are no statements by Mr. Parker, no knowledge of the drugs, or even if he has a prior use of drugs in his history. We have no idea how long Mr. Parker had been in that vehicle. As the court pointed out earlier, we have nothing in the record that the dome light was on or that Mr. Parker had stopped at a store or anywhere else where it was illuminated and bright and he could see in the vehicle. We don't know who this vehicle is registered to. We don't know if it's a family member or a close friend. There's no picture showing how the bag was situated on the passenger seat. So again, we don't know how large this partial opening is. Also, Mr. Parker made no attempts to throw the alleged drugs out of the windows when he's making these illegal turns at the red lights. Also, Mr. Parker did not attempt to take the drugs with him when he exited the vehicle or to even throw them under the seat when exiting the vehicle. I think that defies logic. If he had knowledge of those drugs beside him, why would he not try and hide them? And so I think it's just important that that opaque bag is analogous to if these drugs had been found in the glove compartment or even in the center console, we would not be here today. We would argue he does not have knowledge with the mere fact of them being in that opaque bag. I think they are analogous to being in the center console or the glove compartment as well. All that the court, obviously the test is the totality of circumstances, and here all that we have to indicate Mr. Parker, or that the court relied upon, was that Mr. Parker was the sole occupant in a vehicle containing drugs and that he fled from those officers, but would argue that there is a alternative explanation for that flight, and that is driving with a suspended license or having warrants out on him. I think that there's such a wide gap in the chain of circumstances that it's fatal to the Commonwealth's evidence. I understand the Commonwealth did rely on some cases indicating flight, but just would point out that to distinguish those cases, to distinguish from Langhorne and Leonard, Mr. Parker had not yet been charged for the possession of these drugs when he fled. In those two cases, the defendant had already been charged or at least indicted by a grand jury, and he fled. He failed to appear at trial in Langhorne. Then he fled, or when stopped as a passenger in a vehicle, he gave a fake name, jumped from the vehicle, and attempted to flee. I think that would show a nexus of consciousness of guilt. In Leonard, the defendant was being held in custody on rape, abduction with intent to defile, attempted murder, and he testified that he had attempted to escape from the jail. Again, I think that is a sufficient nexus of consciousness of guilt, which is lacking here. Would point out in Claggett that the defendant went to North Carolina for 24 hours following 5 capital murders that were later charged. And once he was apprehended, he did confess to those murders. So I think we can show that his flight, again, there was a nexus of his consciousness of guilt to what he's charged with.
But in this particular case, though, I mean, the issue is sufficiency. And so the standard is we must affirm unless the evidence is wholly, unless it's wholly without supporting evidence. And here we have proximity and flight. Isn't that enough?
Your Honor, I would argue no. The proximity, I think, just from the statute 18.2250 and 250.1, occupancy in a vehicle where a controlled substance is found does not create a presumption. So I think that alone is not enough.
Right.
I would also argue that the flight, again, it's explained flight, and it is different. There's no consciousness of guilt. There's no nexus here to this possession of the drugs.
But the, you know, I go back to the findings of the trial court. It's a factual finding why he fled. And the trial court obviously believed that he fled because of the drugs in the car. Aren't we bound by that factual finding? Even though you might come up with what you consider to be reasonable hypothesis to the contrary, they weren't accepted by the trial court.
Yes, Your Honor, I would say that the standard is whether a rational fact finder could find the circumstances sufficient, and I would say that it is irrational that the trial court found this sufficient because there is such a lack of evidence that he had knowledge just due to the circumstances I've mentioned previously that all the court is relying on is this flight, and we do know that flight alone is not enough. So again, would point out that that's all that the Commonwealth has here is proximity and occupancy of a vehicle and this flight, which each of them can be canceled out. If there aren't any more questions, I'll reserve any time for rebuttal.
That's fine. Thank you. Mr. Stollard.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Frank Stollard on behalf of the Commonwealth. In my brief, I did say that the drugs were in plain view, and plain view is in quotes. And the reason it's in quotes is because if the court would turn to page 41 of the appendix, the officer testified, and this is starting at page 12. He said that I approached the abandoned vehicle and shined my flashlight inside. It was hard to see because it was drizzly that night or light rain. So he's outside the vehicle looking in. So I used my flashlight to look inside the car, and that's when I observed the evidence in the front right passenger seat. I observed in plain view on the passenger seat a place of a plastic bag that was partially closed, but I could see inside that grocery bag a bag of what's suspected marijuana and a bag of a white powdery substance. He was using a flashlight, but it seems that he's outside the vehicle looking into it. He could still see the bag. He could see inside the bag. He saw a green substance.
But isn't that one of the similarities with Coward, that the drugs were not apparent absent the use of the flashlight?
That's possible. But just the assertion that I misstated the facts in the brief, I'm alerting the court to where I got those facts from. The other issue is clearly proximity and occupancy of the vehicle are standing alone are not sufficient to convict. And we certainly have at least those. He was occupied the vehicle, and he was in proximity to the drugs. But we also have what Coward doesn't have is we also have flight from the police officer. Now, there might be multiple reasons to explain the flight, but as long as at least one of those reasons is the fact he knew drugs were in the vehicle, then we have an additional circumstance which is not in Coward and which would make it sufficient for this court to affirm the conviction. And here, I would also suggest we don't have just flight. It's not a situation where the police officer said, excuse me, can I talk to you, and the defendant turned away and walked away. As soon as the police car pulls in behind this vehicle, the defendant immediately accelerates, runs a red light, turning left. Police officers pursue. He then runs another red light, turning left again. And then he either runs up on the curb or essentially crashes the vehicle and then flees from that vehicle and is later found in an apartment. This wasn't just I need to get away. He was doing everything he possibly could to avoid the police officers. Now, the fact that the defendant didn't do something, I don't know, smarter to try to avoid the police is certainly not a defense. He could have thrown the stuff out of the car, could have hit it in the car. I think, just to suppose here, that it's quite possible since he knew the car wasn't his, if I get away, they're never going to find me. And he almost accomplished that. He got into another apartment where the police officers were fortunate enough to locate him and arrest him for that. The fact that he also had outstanding warrants is irrelevant to the discussion here because one of the reasons he fled was because there were drugs in the car. And the evidence that we know that is because he fled. And he didn't just walk away. He accelerated in a vehicle, ran two stoplights, got out of the car, and continued to run. Because we have occupancy, because we have proximity, and because we have flight, the evidence is clearly sufficient. Finding the trial court was not wrong. And unless the court has additional questions, I'd ask the court to affirm.
Hearing no other questions, we thank you, Mr. Stoller.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. McGee.
Thank you. It pleases the court. Just to address, again, I think it's very important that the court note that without this flashlight, the officer would not have been able to see those drugs. And then we're looking at Mr. Parker's kind of dealing with more his personal observations or his potential view in the vehicle. So again, the officer testified that he had to shine the flashlight because it was dark and drizzly outside. Your Honor, I think the Commonwealth is really heavily relying on this flight. However, there is no nexus between the consciousness of guilt for this possession of these drugs and his flight. As the Commonwealth just stated, Once they got behind Mr. Parker, he sped up and ran lights. Well, there's nothing to show that he knew, oh, no, they know that I have these drugs. And that's important to note and to distinguish from the Commonwealth's cases on flight, because when a person had not yet been charged with specific charges, the circumstances, particularly in U.S. v. Boyle, the defendant in that case used an alias to check into a hotel days after a robbery, which he had committed unmasked. There were several eyewitnesses. There's bank surveillance equipment. And he did have outstanding warrants on him. And so what the court relied on is obviously that his name and face would be known to the police because of those outstanding warrants and then would be able to compare that to this unmasked robber. And that's why Mr. Boyle was using a fake name. Here, that is missing. There's nothing to indicate the officer saw when driving, oh, he has drugs, or we know his name, or we saw his face and can look at him later. That is lacking in this case. It's also important to note with in regards to the Ricks versus Commonwealth case that the defendant fled from officers in his vehicle. This is days after a murder. Once he'd been apprehended, he did confess to that murder, and they found that the consciousness of guilt in that case, or the nexus towards the consciousness of guilt in his flight and from that murder, would be because the body was in a place where it would be found, and thus he had knowledge that there would be a murder charge against him pending. Again, there's no nexus between his flight and this possession of the drugs beside him. So I think that's very important for the court to understand that. And I would argue that this is Coward, almost exact facts. Here the officers pulled up. The testimony was that the lights were on and flashing. I don't know if that's just the blue lights and the spotlight or what, some combination of those two. And it isn't until the officer shines his flashlight that he's able to see anything. The two other officers ran past the car, shined their light at the vehicle, just to make sure no one else was in the vehicle, and they didn't see, obviously, drugs sitting beside him. Again, they're in an opaque, innocuous grocery bag. And without statements by Mr. Parker of how long he'd been in the car, if he had placed anything on that seat, anything like that, the evidence, again, is just so lacking that he had knowledge that all the court is relying on is flight. And here the flight is explained, and there is no sufficient nexus in the consciousness of guilt to the possession of these drugs beside him that I would argue that there is, looking at the totality of circumstances, no rational fact finder could find him guilty. So I would ask the court to reverse and dismiss.
Very well. We'll step down and greet counsel and thereafter take up the case of Taylor versus the Commonwealth.
All rise.